Welcome to Behind the Page, the Eli Marks podcast, with your hosts, John Gaspard, and me, Jim Cunningham.
Hey there, Jim.
Hey, John, how are you?
I'm good. It's good to see you again.
Nice to be seen. Nice to see you.
Yeah. I didn't send you any of the stuff we got on Matt Donnelly, because they didn't mention you as being a great narrator, although I'm sure they all thought that.
I'm sure they did, yeah.
People were pleased with that, and Matt Donnelly himself even was happy with the interview. So, hey, let's score one for us.
Good for us. I enjoyed talking to him. And if that show should whistle through Minneapolis, I think we ought to go.
Yeah. I would not be surprised if there's at some point some form of Matt Donnelly will come through the Twin Cities for us to see. And it'd be another one of those things we promised to go see that we haven't gone to see, but we're going to try to go see.
A lot of those things are not in this state, John.
That's true. That's
I'm
true.
Willing to go places. But if they come to me, the chances of me then going to them escalate.
Totally.
Yeah.
Totally. If anyone's unsure, this is episode 8 of season 4. We are, I think, this will put us 1/3 of the way through the season.
Huh.
24 divided. No, 1/3. Yeah, 1/3 of the way through. 24 divided by 3 is 8. Mm-hmm. Right?
That's correct.
Okay, there we go. So that's all good. This is one of the, what do you call the even episodes, 408. And on generally the even episodes, we're going to be a little bit shorter than the longer ones. We're going to take a look back at something somebody said that was interesting and just kind of revisit it for a minute. And this episode, when I thought about what did I want to pull from Mike Caveney's interview, the problem was there was so much stuff.
Exactly.
But when we talked to him, he had just released his book, Sawing. And we got, if you haven't heard that episode, go back and listen, because it's a great history of the sawing a lady in half illusion, which is different than the sawing a lady in two illusion, as we learned. But there was one moment with Dante's version of that illusion that he talked about as being the highlight of his career.
As you'll hear, he gets chills talking about it. And I don't know about you, John, but I got chills listening to it. So here he is, folks, our friend Mike Caveney, talking about how he acquired and then let go of perhaps one of the most iconic props in magic, Dante's sawing in half illusion.
I love talking about this because that one night, I can honestly say, was one of the highlights of my entire career. I get chills just thinking about it, and I'll try to tell you why. You have to go back to 1921 when Howard Thurston said to Horace Golden, I'll give you $1,000 for the rights, and in my workshop, we'll build two new props that are beautiful, and you'll have a new one. Well, the guy that Thurston hired to work in his workshop was a young Harry Janson, who was already a great magician. He had already toured the world once with an illusion show. So he was an experienced builder and was very familiar with illusion design. And then when he became Dante and he went out around the world and he performed this trick for the rest of his career, his long career, he lived until 1955. About three times during his career, he rebuilt this trick using all of the new technology or the new subtleties that he had figured out. And each version was better and better. And the third version that he built, I would say, was an absolute masterpiece of deception and construction. When Dante retired, he bought a ranch in Southern California, where I live. I never knew him because he died when I was just a little tiny kid. But his son, Al Janson, still lived at the ranch when I was a teenager. And Dante's show was still stored out there. A person that I knew, his name was John Daniel, a wonderful, wonderful illusionist. And John, who was quite a bit older than me, he was very good friends with Al Janson, Dante's son. And John bought all kinds of stuff, photographs and things from Al, from Dante's career, including that third Sawing a Lady in Half box. And one day he said, you want to buy this? And I said, yes, I do. And so I bought this Dante prop, brought it home, put it in my basement. Now, way back, like in the 1930s, when Dante was touring Australia, he needed a new assistant. And he remembered a girl in a show that was across the street from his show She was a dancer, and her name was Moyo Miller. And he said, how would you like to go with my magic show? And she said, yes. Well, Moyo Miller didn't just become his assistant. She became his co-star. And in every poster of the day, there was a picture of Dante and a picture of Moyo. And she then toured the world with Dante right up till the end of his career. She estimated, I think it was, she had been sawn in half 11,800 times. I don't know who was keeping score, but Moyo always told me that because I knew Moyo, a wonderful, wonderful lady. And when you hear about people saying this person has the it factor, or this person, you know, walks into a room and lights up the room, I haven't known many people like that, but Moyo was one of them. And her husband, amazingly, Arturo Montes, was also an assistant on the Dante show. Arturo was the one who largely built this Sawing a Lady in Half illusion that I now owned. So when they came over once to visit, we went down in the basement and I wanted them to see it. They hadn't seen this trick in decades. Moyo was in her late 70s at this point. And I can't believe I said this, but I did. And I said, Moyo, do you think you could still do this trick? But before I could say anything else, she kicked her shoes off. She hopped up on this table, crawled into the box, laid down, and she said, yeah, I don't think it would be a problem. I said, okay, here's what's going to happen. I said, we do a magic history conference every other year. At the next one, I want to saw you in half in the old box that you used to do it in with Dante. And I want Arturo to be on the other end of the saw. They thought this was a great idea. So at that year's conference, I did a little talk about the history of the sawing trick and said, and now we've got a little treat for everybody. And the curtain opened, and there's Dante's beautiful prop on the stage. Now, again, for this conference is for magic historians. Everybody in this audience, they know the story of Dante. They know the basic history of Sawing a Lady in Half. And they know that Moyo Miller is a rock star in the magic world. And when Moyo walked out on the stage, basically Arturo and I became invisible, because here is this iridescent lady recreating this role that she had done 11,800 times. And Arturo and I sawed her in half, and it was thrilling. And here's the interesting thing. I love this story. David Copperfield used to come to my house and he would see this prop and he would say, you got to sell me this prop. And I used to say, David, you don't have enough money to buy this prop. That drove him crazy because he has enough money to buy anything on earth. And then I sawed Moyo in half and I thought, what am I going to ever do with this prop that tops that night? It's impossible. I have gone to the top of the mountain with this thing. And I called David and said, hey, you want this trick? You can't buy it, but you can trade me for it. So we did a great trade. And now that Dante Sawing a Lady in Half has a prominent place in David's museum. Instead of sitting in my basement where nobody sees it, it looks fantastic. And right next to it is Moyo's costume that she wore doing this trick. And it's in the right place.
Oh, boy. Of course, it's talking about another thing we've never gone to go see that we will someday. We'd love to go see David Copperfield's museum and
see. Yeah, that's exactly that right. Let's put that out there, John. Let's put that out there into the universe right now. I would so love to see that collection. And we know people who have seen that collection.
I know, yeah.
And we know people who have seen that collection that may not like us, but don't dislike us.
If you're out there.
Yes, please. I'm putting out in the universe. I'd love to walk through that. But I won't go if you can't go. John, okay. We have to go together, or I want nothing to do with it. I wash all my right. hands and my feet of it.
Okay, universe, I hope you're listening. In listening back to Mike's story, I just love the part where, okay, so he bought the prop and put it in his basement. I mean, what else are you going to do? I think he married the right woman.
Because, well, we all did.
Yeah. I mean, the idea of, okay, I'm just going to go buy this entire collection and bring it home. And now I'm going to go out and buy this huge prop and bring it home. And then to have her over for dinner, to have Moyo there and she's in her 70s and say, hey, why don't you try getting in that? And then doing it again, another thing we should try to go to, the history conference.
I'd love to do that too.
Yeah.
Maybe there's next time. Is it always in Vegas?
I think it's always in LA.
Always in LA? No, that's another thing we should do. Maybe, and then we go to the Magic Castle, and then on the way home, stop at Vegas and walk through the museum. I'm just spitballing here.
Might
now.
As well see Matt King's show while we're there.
And Penn and Teller.
Yeah,
and
might as well.
By that point, my guess is Matt Donnelly will have something up in Vegas that we can go see.
Yep. Yeah. So we're going to be very busy when that happens.
It's a trip, boy. What a trip that'll be.
I'm glad I pulled that story of Mike Caveney. I love the fact that he said to David Copperfield, you don't have enough money to buy this, but I will trade you.
Isn't that great?
It is. It's just great.
And I think in the original interview, I talked about Dante being in a Laurel and Hardy movie, which was, to me, as big as it could get when I was a kid. Yeah. If you made it into a Laurel and Hardy movie, you're the coolest. And so I had a fascination with Dante because of that. It was what a cool story. What a cool prop. I would love to see it. We've already put it out there in the universe. Let's see what happens. Yeah. Let's continue reading the book. That's, after all, what brought us together. John, what happened in chapter 7?
Chapter 7 was spent entirely with the author Clifford Thomas at his house on Summit Avenue at the Summit Club, and then walking the inebriated and depressed author home. And that's where Eli leaves him, and that takes us right into chapter 8.
Chapter 8. You may need to reassess your definition of crowded in terms of its relationship to this store. It was a convoluted thought, but I knew exactly what Nathan meant. A perpetually low-energy children's magician, Nathan had a slow, thoughtful way of speaking which could be lulling in its monotone cadences. His perceptions may have been slow in coming, but were nearly always dead on, and his thoughts on what now constituted a crowd were no exception. In the past, when we referred to Chicago Magic as being crowded, we were likely referring to a sudden rush of customers amounting to at most 5 people. 5 was a crowd. 6 would be thought of as crushing. And with the exception of a handful of Magic Club meetings when I was a kid, I couldn't remember when we'd have more than a dozen people in the store at the same time. A quick and likely inaccurate head count on my part totaled at least 25 people, and the jingle of the bell over the door signaled the arrival of even more patrons. "You're going to need to put out more chairs," Nathan said without recognizing the understatement he was making. "Hell, we're going to have to buy more chairs," I said. "I'll go over to the bar and see what I can borrow. I think we're going to have to move this whole thing into the shop and back. Can you head back there and make some room?" Nathan nodded. He turned left while I turned right, and 20 minutes later, the back room was set with a charmingly mismatched array of chairs. Every blessed one of them was occupied, along with a line of people in SRO positions against the back wall. "This guy must be pretty good," Nathan murmured quietly. "You've seen him, right? This guy we're seeing?" "Who?" I asked, having lost track of his question, as I did a quick head count, giving up after I passed 30 heads. "This magician, Quentin Moon. He's supposed to be great, right?" I turned sharply to Nathan, expecting to see a wicked leer, but there was no sense of taunting in his expression. "Yeah," I said. "We saw him the other night. He's not bad." Nathan nodded slowly and looked around the room. "This is quite a crowd for being not bad," he said with typical understatement. As if on cue, at that moment, the back door swung open and Quentin strode in, looking like Dr. Zhivago as the wind swirled a circling cascade of snow around him. He wore a long gray duster, and his hair was swept back in a styled but not too styled casual look. Harry, all bundled and blustery, stepped in behind him, his eyes growing wide at the sight of the mob which occupied our normally empty back room. "You're late," I whispered to Harry, as the adoring fans slowly approached Quentin, seeming to bask in his glow.
"We stopped for breakfast, and then we gave him a quick spin around the lakes."
"We?" As if in answer, the door opened again, revealing Franny Higgins, and right on her heels, Megan. Franny is a tiny bird-like woman, so small that Megan nearly towers over her. Both are psychics, with Megan still floundering in her amateur status, while Franny makes a good living as a phone psychic, putting in banker's hours and rarely offering psychic observations outside of her 9-to-5 schedule. In the past several months, she and Harry have been spending more and more time together, which has been as charming to watch as it was puzzling. A staunch debunker of psychics throughout his career, I was surprised to see Harry seem to be able to set all that aside in his growing relationship with Franny. For his part, Harry saw no real conflict. "Your late Aunt Alice was a dyed-in-the-wool Republican," he told me. "Besides canceling out each other's votes at every election, I made that work for over 50 years. This is hardly any different." Megan caught my eye at that moment, and I set aside my musings on Harry's relationships. "Hi there," I said, looking from her to Franny and Harry, who were both helping Quentin with his coat. "The three of you picked up Quentin this morning?" "Harry asked Franny to drive, and she was afraid it was too slippery," Megan explained. "I volunteered. Of course, then we ended up being early because it wasn't slippery at all, so all four of us went to breakfast and then took a quick detour around a couple of the lakes. Q wanted to see them." "Q?" She laughed. "He said I could call him Q. People call him that. I thought it was cute." I struggled to quickly craft a James Bond joke out of all of this, but sadly came up short. "Q, huh?" I said, working hard to keep anything resembling a tone out of my voice. "How was your breakfast?" I continued, as casually as possible. "Not bad," she said, all innocent. Or perhaps I was imagining it, or not. "How was yours?" I shrugged. "Half a stale Pop-Tart and a piece of leftover pizza and orange juice," I said, turning and pretending to be interested in something across the room.
"Breakfast at Champions," she said.
We stood silently side by side for several more seconds. "Are you staying for the lecture?" I finally said. "Or have you had enough of Q for one day?"
"Hardly," she laughed. "He's a real charmer. But no, Franny needs to get to work. I need to open the store, and I really don't want to know how he does any of those amazing illusions."
This gave me pause as I immediately registered that in her mind, Quentin did amazing illusions, while I assumed I merely made my living doing little tricks. "Okay, then," I said, glancing at my watch without noting the time. "We should probably get this party started."
"All right, I'll see you later."
I turned, planning to plant an oh-so-casual kiss on her cheek, but she was already halfway across the room. She joined Franny, and after exchanging some pleasant words with Harry, they headed toward the door.
"Ladies, ladies,"
a voice stopped them in their tracks. They turned to see Quentin. He momentarily abandoned his flock and pushed across the room to give, I assumed, his goodbyes to the two women. I couldn't hear what he said, but given how Megan giggled and how Franny swatted him playfully on the arm, I gather it was nauseatingly charming. I stood there glowering and would have continued doing that for several more minutes if Nathan hadn't broken my concentration. "Wow, everybody loves him and he hasn't done a thing yet." "That might be his best trick," I said through gritted teeth. "If it is, I hope he teaches it this morning." I am ashamed to admit it, but on some level, I was really hoping the lecture would be a bust. I'm not proud of it, but there you have it. However, once again, I was foiled, and once again, he was brilliant. Quentin performed for about 45 minutes, offering one stunning illusion after another, without repeating anything he had done at the show earlier in the week. The audience of geeky magicians sat spellbound for the entire act, oohing and eyeing as if on cue at all the right moments. Like he had done with his chamber show, this performance was an equal mix of old chestnuts polished into new life and brand new effects, which stunned me into a stupefied, grumpy silence.
The final piece he introduced with, "This one is still rather new. I've only been working on it for 15 years. This produced a laugh and then stunned silence as he performed a three-card Monty routine with oversized playing cards that was absolutely mystifying. The applause at the end of his act was long and passionate, and as they had done at the hotel show earlier in the week, the audience jumped to their feet. I imagined he must be getting tired of standing ovations. I'm sure I would be if that happened with any regularity at the end of my act, or for that matter, ever. With the performance behind us, next came the lecture, at which I assumed he, like many lecturing magicians, would offer some tidbits without providing any real information or insight into how he achieved his effects. And once again, I was wrong. With an openness and candor which surprised me, he walked us through each illusion, freely giving up the details on every move, every sleight, and his thinking behind what really works in a performance setting. His ideas were original, his approach was cutting edge, and after the third explanation, I was ready to trash my entire act and get a job at Trader Joe's washing the produce. As I stewed, I also silently wished he had done his version of the miser's dream today, so I could learn how he made all but one of the coins vanish from the bucket in the final phase of the trick. As a fellow magician, I knew it was something I could take him aside later and ask. Given his open nature, he would very likely give me all the details and more. And yet, I didn't see myself ever stepping forward and asking that question. For that matter, I could have put the same question to one of the mystics, Sam Esbjornsson, who did his own variation on the miser's dream. He didn't conclude his version with the disappearing coins, but odds were he would have a clue as to its solution. Yet for some reason, my pride wouldn't let me ask, while my ignorance continued to drive me nuts. As Quentin began the explanation of his three-card Monty routine, I was surprised to see Harry, who'd been sitting on a stool we'd grabbed from the store, get up and quietly step out of the back room. I followed him into the store, pulling back the curtain after stepping through it. Quentin's voice, now muffled, could be heard vaguely from the back room. He was talking about the value of time misdirection and his theory on the importance in magic of separating the cause from the effect. "You had enough as well?" I asked Harry as we stepped into the shop. Harry turned. He looked surprised to see I had followed him out.
"What's that?"
"You had enough of the lecture?" I repeated. "Me too. I mean, enough's enough, right?" Harry shook his head.
"On the contrary, I think it's the best lecture I've ever witnessed. Ever."
I furrowed my brow. "Then why did you leave?"
"He's about to explain his three-card Monty routine," he began.
I nodded as I cut him off. "Right, and you already know how it's done. Pretty simple trick, really." In truth, I had absolutely no idea how he had accomplished the illusion.
"On the contrary," Harry said, "it's such an amazing trick, I truly don't want to know how it's done."
He registered the puzzled look on my face.
"Eli," he continued, "it's not often I can be fooled these days, and so when those opportunities arise, I pounce on them."
He slid open the curtain which led to the upstairs apartments.
"It's been an eventful morning," he said as he turned to me. "Be a dear. Give Quentin a ride back to his hotel when this is all done, will you?"
He didn't wait for a response and was out of sight before I had mustered even a plausible excuse to avoid the dreaded chore. Having nothing else to do, I was reluctantly going to head back into the lecture when my phone began to buzz in my pocket. I had turned off the ringtone for the duration of the lecture, so I was forced to actually look at the phone to see who was calling.
"Morning, sunshine," I said, summoning an unnaturally cheery disposition, which was in sharp contrast to my actual mood. "What can I do for the district attorney's office on this chilly, snowy Saturday?"
"How did it go with Clifford Thomas?"
Deirdre said sharply, sidestepping any traditional greetings.
"How did it go?" I repeated.
"Fine, I think.
I didn't gather much insight, if that's what you mean. I had a nice sandwich, got to watch him get drunk. I'm taking it he didn't confess? If he did, he did it so obliquely it sailed right over my head. Figures. I could hear rustling paper through the phone. We have two more people you can talk to, she continued. The conversations we had with them were no more enlightening than the one you had with Mr. Thomas. Can you write this down? I moved behind the counter, and after digging through some drawers, seemingly crammed with everything but paper and pen, I finally put together the proper set of tools. Shoot, I said, and quickly scribbled down the names and phone numbers as she rattled them off. I read back the phone numbers to ensure accuracy. Anything else to report? I asked as I stuffed the slip of paper into my pocket. Not much, she said with a sigh. Information is coming in dribs and drabs. Turns out the projectionist was using a false name. Really? I said. So he wasn't really Tyler James? No, he took an imaginative leap from his actual name, which was James Tyler. He gets points for simplicity. Anything else of note? I could hear her flipping through some more sheets of paper. Fred brought the theater manager in for more questioning, she finally said. Nothing to report there. Noteworthy background, though. Turns out she was a champion NCAA athlete. This gave me pause. But I finally said, Tracy's not black. This produced a very familiar sigh from the other end of the line. Not NAACP, you moron. NCAA, National Collegiate Athletic Association. Oh, I said. My mistake, I added, fully cognizant of the fact that Deirdre had a personal understanding of my lack of sports knowledge. Did she have any connection with Tyler? I mean, James? Whatever. We checked, but her story holds up. They met when she took the job at the theater last spring. Before that, she was playing ball for an international team in Japan. And Tyler? James, the projectionist, I finally settled on. He'd been at the theater for years? 15 years. No family to speak of. We searched his apartment and came up with some items that, if they aren't hot, are certainly warm. His bank accounts suggest he was doing a good business. Until the other night. Yes, his business took a sharp downturn the other night. A pause while I searched my mind for any other pertinent or impertinent questions. You still have one person to talk to off Mr. Lime's list? That's right. And now you have two people to talk to. Looks like we both have work to do, I suggested. Whatever, was all she said, and then she hung up. As he had done at his performance earlier in the week, Quentin took time to talk to each member of the audience at the conclusion of the lecture. This process started in the back room and gradually transitioned into the store proper, primarily because Quentin kept answering questions by referring people to products we sold in the shop. Before long, he was behind the counter, demonstrating products with consummate skill and, in the process, ringing up considerable sales for us. You should hire him full-time, Nathan suggested, as we marveled at Quentin's skill with the customers. Not only is he making money for you, but he didn't even bring any products of his own to sell. Once he pointed this out, I realized Nathan was correct. Magicians who tour the country giving lectures always, repeat, always had products to sell. They could range from simple photocopied lecture notes to books, DVDs, and even custom tricks and gaffes. Quentin had none of these wares to proffer, but was instead doing a great job selling the items we had in the store, some of which had sat on the shelves for months or even years. If nothing else, he was certainly going to make the task of inventorying when we finally got around to it a lot easier. As the crowd began to finally dwindle, I noticed one kid of about 10 or 11 who was shyly standing off to one side of the store, surveying the action. It looked like he was gathering up the courage to approach Quentin, but he kept not making the move. I sidled up alongside him. Waiting to talk to Mr. Moon? I asked quietly. I don't know, he shrugged. Maybe.
He kicked at the carpet with his tennis shoe and looked everywhere but at me. You know, when I was your age, I had a chance to meet Di Vernon. Do you know who that is? I figured he might know Chris Angel or David Blaine, but would be unlikely to know Vernon. The professor, sure. And it's Day. Excuse me? You said Di. People who knew him on the West Coast only pronounced it that way. But his true friends from the East Coast pronounced it Day. I considered this for a moment. I met him on the West Coast. Sure thing, he said, still looking nervous and avoiding my gaze. Look, I'm trying to give you a motivational pep talk. Do you want it or not? I suppose, he nodded, and I continued. I was about your age, and my uncle had taken me to the Magic Castle in Los Angeles. The night we were there, Day Vernon was sitting in his regular chair in the lounge. I knew who he was. I wanted to talk to him, but I was terrified. I mean, it was Day Vernon, I said, consciously conforming to the kid's preferred pronunciation of the first name. What'd you do? He said, finally looking up at me. I gathered up all my courage and walked up to him and said, Professor, can you tell me what I'm doing wrong on my top change? Kid's eyes went wide. What did he say? He said, I was doing everything wrong, I said, letting the phrase settle in. I then repeated it, doing my fairly accurate impression of the professor's nasally twang. You're doing everything wrong. Scratch any magician who spent any time with Vernon, and he'll give you his own impression. The kid smiled, either at the story or at the impression.
Really?
I nodded. Yep. Then he spent an hour showing me how to do it right. I'm really glad now I was brave enough to do it back then.
And how's your top change?
Still sort of sucky. This made him laugh, and then he saw a break in the action with Quentin. I gave him the slightest of shoves, and he moved forward, gaining confidence as he crossed the shop. For his part, Quentin saw him coming and bent down to receive his question. He then spent the next 15 minutes answering it for him. It was a full 2 hours later when Quentin and I stepped out of the front door of the shop, and I turned to lock the door. Harry hadn't come back downstairs, so I made the executive decision to close up the store for the rest of the day. I figured, given the size of the turnout for the lecture, every possible customer we possessed had already been in the store that morning and was unlikely to return. You are quite the demonstrator of products, I said as I pulled the door shut and waited to hear the reassuring snick of the lock slipping into place. I used my key to turn the deadbolt.
Am I? Well, I did a stint as a magic demonstrator at Harrod's while at university, Quentin said, turning up the collar of his long coat to the sharp wind which was whipping down Chicago Avenue. Having done it for years, so I was a tad surprised at how quickly it all came back.
My mind toyed with a quick riposte about riding a bike and bicycle brand playing cards, but I once again came up short. I headed toward the car, but in this mentally clouded state, I nearly collided with a ladder in the middle of the sidewalk. Quentin reached out and pulled me to safety. I looked up to see a figure in a parka near the top of the ladder, adding large black metal letters to the theater's marquee. While the jacket did a great job of obscuring the figure inside it, when I saw the reach she had in extending her arm to add a letter to the marquee, I knew it had to be Tracy. Although I know literally nothing about basketball, I had to imagine that long arms would be something of an advantage in the game.
Are you still short a little help?
I asked loudly, suddenly wondering to myself if tall people take offense when you use the word short around them. She glanced around, wondering where the sound had come from, and then looked down at us. Her face was visible through the faux fur that enveloped the hood of the parka.
I learned that theater managers are like mailmen, she said,
looking remarkably upbeat despite the cold conditions.
Rain, sleet, snow, hail. No game is ever called on account of weather.
I stepped back and surveyed her work. Currently it read, Guess Who's Coming? Guess who's coming, I said out loud slowly.
Clearly, the first feature is Guess Who's Coming to Dinner. That is the favorite, she said, digging through the box, which hung on the ladder's rungs, and pulling out another letter. Are you ready to double down on the rest of it? Not quite, I said, squinting at the marquee as if that action would somehow make me smarter. I turned to Quentin, who was watching this exchange with a bemused smile. The theater runs these oddball double features, I began to explain, but he waved it away.
Oh, yes, your uncle mentioned it when we drove by the theater earlier today. At that point, the marquee read, let me think.
He snapped his fingers.
It was Gone with the Mighty Wind.
He looked up at the marquee again and hummed softly for a moment.
How about Guess Who's Coming to My Dinner with Andre? He suggested.
And we have a winner, Tracy said with a laugh.
She descended two rungs of the ladder and put her hand out.
I'm Tracy, by the way.
Well, Tracy, by the way, I'm Quentin Moon, and it is a sheer delight to meet you.
He shook her hand, adding in a quick pat with the left hand to complete the action. Somehow, he was able to turn every moment into a James Bond charm fest. Quentin gave a lecture on magic this morning in the shop, I said, in a weak bid to stay in the conversation.
I'll bet that was fun, Tracy said, her wicked smile visible within the confines of the parka hood.
More likely tedious, Quentin said. I prattled on at length, not at all sure what I said.
He's being modest, I said, for some reason feeling the need to take on the role of his PR person. The audience was spellbound.
Oh, and that's another possible double feature for you, if I'm allowed to suggest, he said, his eyes twinkling. Spellbound for glory.
Tracy laughed, and I joined in half-heartedly. I had to admit it was a pretty good off-the-cuff suggestion.
Thanks, she said. I'll add it to my ever-growing list.
She started to reclimb the ladder, then turned back when she reached the top.
Nice to meet you. Stop by any time for some free popcorn.
I will happily take you up on that kind offer. If my schedule permits, he said with the tip of his hat, using the British pronunciation of the word schedule, which I usually find charming, but not at present. Good day.
He looked to me for direction as to where we were headed. I pointed him toward my car, and we started to trudge toward it, my self-loathing-filled grumblings lost in the sound of traffic on the street.
She seems like a charming girl, don't you think? I mean, she's no Megan, but delightful nonetheless.
I winced at his mention of Megan and nearly missed my turn onto the freeway.
Tracy? I said, feigning ignorance. I don't know her all that well, but yes, she seems nice.
But no Megan.
Yes. I mean, no. I merged into traffic and then attempted to merge this conversation into a different direction.
You have a corporate gig this week?
Yes, he said. An insurance group. Wonderful people.
Another pause, which may or may not have been awkward. I was no longer able to adequately judge. For his part, Quentin seemed content to look at the snow landscape as it sailed past his window. They certainly loved your lecture, I finally came up with. It was nice of you to take the time.
Happy to do it, he said, turning away from the window. You know what Arturo de Ascanio y Navez said about magic?
Of course, I didn't. I didn't even know who he was talking about.
Ascanio, I said, butchering the name.
You know, he created the Ascanio spread.
Oh, right, I said, really having no idea if this was a card move or something you put on toast.
I'm paraphrasing, he said, ignoring my blathering. But he said something to the effect of, magic is like gardening. It requires constant attention. I've found that to be essentially true.
Had enough about magic for one moment, he continued, shifting in his seat to give me his full attention.
Your uncle mentioned you were part of a murder investigation?
That must be fascinating. Yes, I said slowly. I think you could say I'm officially on the far edge of the periphery of the case.
And a locked room murder, no less. That must be enthralling. Can you give me the pertinent particulars of the case?
I glanced over at him, and he raised an eyebrow at me. I considered my options.
I'm not really sure I'm at liberty to discuss the details, I said, enjoying the officious sensation the statement provided.
Oh, understood, Quentin said quickly. Completely understood. However, judging from the details your uncle provided,
he then went on to outline each and every facet of the case, which Harry must have presented in minute detail. As it turned out, Quentin Moon knew exactly what I knew about the murder investigation, and for all I knew, probably more.
I've had some experience in my travels, he continued, with the buying and selling of rare and precious artifacts. In my case, it's generally been in the magic realm, you understand?
Sure, I lied, not fully understanding. Such as, I said, gesturing for him to fill in the details.
Oh, all types of miscellanea and ephemera. A blooming orange tree illusion reputed to belong to Thurston, he said offhandedly. Some letters from Houdini to his brother. The gun that killed Chang Ling Su.
He turned and looked out the window as we wound our way through the streets of downtown St. Paul, which was snowy and quiet.
In this world, Eli, he continued, I've learned for every soul who has something they treasure, there's almost always someone else who wants to take it from them, often by whatever means necessary.
I wasn't sure how to respond to this statement, or if a response was even required. I was still sifting through conversational options as I maneuvered the car through the circular drive in front of the St. Paul Hotel. Anyway, I said, falling back on our earlier topic, thanks again for coming to do the lecture.
And thank you, he said, taking my hand in a warm grip, for the fine transport. I am sure, beyond all measure, my path will cross yours and Megan's in the not-too-distant future.
I suppressed a wince at his continued mention of Megan, but before I could compose a response, he was out of the car and on his way into the hotel. As he strolled up the long red carpet which led to the gilded front doors, I wasn't in the least bit surprised he seemed to be on a first-name basis with the valets and bellmen, all of whom he greeted like long-lost friends. He was truly warm and convivial with each and every one of them. God, he was annoying.
So there's one bit in that chapter that I took from my own experience when Harry leaves the lecture as Quentin's about to explain how something's done. I did that same thing at Magi Fest. Juan Tamarez was giving a presentation. He had done kind of a oversized three-card Monty routine, which was baffling. And he was going to talk about that in his lecture. And I remember David Parr warning me. He said, he will tease the audience for about an hour before he'll actually tell you anything's done. He'll talk about where your feet should be. He'll talk about everything but the trick. And he was right. He really did tease the audience for a long time. And then he showed us how it worked. And the way it worked was so stupid.
It almost always is.
Yeah. That he then went into an explanation of the next trick that he had done. And I thought, I don't want to know anymore. It's just better not knowing.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, once you learn what the magician does, it's not magic anymore. It's largely, and I don't mean this disparagingly at all, but it's largely stupid. And you just get, you're better off to hold on to that magical experience and get the hell out of the room before someone says, well, this is how I did it. I don't want to know. I'd prefer not knowing.
Yep. Yep. The other thing that I wanted to ask you about in that chapter, because it's a lot of time spent with Quentin Moon, who I think I've said in earlier episodes, is based on Tommy Wonder. The idea of what if this phenomenal, handsome, charming, brilliant magician came to town and was interested in your girlfriend. That's what Eli's going through in The Miser's Dream. How do you solve a problem like Quentin Moon? And he's completely intimidated by him. And I was just wondering if, have you run into that where you've run into another performer, whether it's acting or emceeing or magic, where you just like, oh, I can't even stand in his or her shadow.
Yeah, all the time. All the time. It's there are so many. I've been blessed in so many ways to meet so many of my both childhood idols and adult heroes. And I am always intimidated by them. I Bill Murray. When I met Bill Murray, I could barely speak. And he was so nice to me. So nice to me. Mm-hmm. And I could barely speak. I mean, I can barely speak about it now. I mean, yes, absolutely. None of them ever hit on my wife. That would have, I think, loosened my tongue. I really have a great respect for a lot of performers, for most performers, regardless of where they are in the hierarchy. I have a great respect for performers, and I am always thinking about I will always say, I'm just a kid from St. Paul. I don't know what the heck I'm doing here. How did I get here? This is crazy. All the time. And some of those times, you know, we were together and we're meeting the Smothers Brothers, for instance. Yep. And who else in that list of, I mean, there were some Louis Anderson.
Yeah, Louis was charming and nice. It's fun when you meet them and you find out how human they are right away. When you weren't there for that show, but I did get him to call you and leave a message with Ray Romano, who was a huge success at that time. That's nothing bigger than his TV show. He's doing stand-up. He's going to do a corporate event, and he couldn't have been more nervous. He could have been, you know, who's his crowd again? They're bankers in their 20s and 30s. They're not going to like this at all. And, you know, he got a standing ovation just walking on stage. It's fun when you feel like you're going to be intimidated and then you find out just how human they really are. I remember doing a show with Louis Anderson and he came off stage and I said, "You killed." He said, "Would have killed longer, but my knee was killing me. I had to get off stage."
Oh my gosh. The Romano story is a great one. And I tell it all the time. Have I told it on the podcast?
I'm not sure you have.
So you called me out of the blue. And I was driving to Duluth and I was listening to Ray Romano's book on tape. And you said, "Hey, let me pick your brain for a second. We're trying to come up with somebody to headline this corporate show in Florida. And we've had some pretty heavy hitters do it in the past. Can you think of anybody that we're not thinking of?" And because I was listening to the man's book, I said, "What about Ray Romano? I'm almost done with the book. I'll drop it off. He's very funny. He's got his own TV show." And you called him. He turned you down. His manager turned you down and then called back and said, "No, you know what? It does slot in right now perfectly. So we'll do it." And I said to you, "Well, if he turns out to be half the guy he is on the TV show, mention that an Italian kid from St. Paul recommended him for this gig and see if he wants to call me and, you know, kibitz." And my phone rings. I'm coming home from a wedding and my phone rings and I answer it. My whole family's in the car. "Jim, it's Ray Romano. Your friend John said I got you to thank for this gig I'm going to." I said, because I get tongue-tied around the biggies. He said, "What are you doing?" I said, "I'm coming home from a wedding." "From the Italian side of your family?" I said, "Yeah, from the Italian side." "Did you stay for the chicken dance?" I said, "No, actually, you call yourself an Italian and you didn't stay for the chicken dance?" I don't do a great Ray Romano, but it's a moment that, you know, he has forgotten completely, but I will never forget. And it just out of the goodness of his heart.
I think we're on our way to a sound check. We're walking down a hall. I said, "The thing you said about this guy recommended you. Oh, do you mind calling him?" "Oh, yeah, sure." And he did all that. And then I believe he ended it with, "Jim, I'm stepping in an elevator here. I think we might get," and then
it was gone.
He was gone.
Yes. When you talk about intimidation, I think everybody gets intimidated. I don't know if you have taken the time yet. There's a Netflix making of We Are the World.
Yes. I'll put a link
to that.
Yes, I did watch it.
And you can watch those people at the height of their powers, Bruce Springsteen, Michael Jackson, Lionel Richie, Paul Simon, Kenny Rogers, Cyndi Lauper, Huey Lewis, Bob Dylan. You can watch them, Stevie Wonder, all in that room together, and all of them are intimidated by the other people in the room. Mm-hmm. It's just, I mean, Bob Dylan can't figure out how to beat Bob Dylan in the moment they need him to.
Stevie Wonder has to show him how to do it.
Yeah, it's intimidation, I think, is a good thing. It means that there is a humbleness that I just think it's a good thing. Being intimidated by someone is great. I don't think it's a bad thing. It does make me unable to speak temporarily, but it's not a bad thing, I don't think.
No, it's not at all. Yeah. Well, let's move on to our next episode. I'll just tell you what's coming up next. I was so intimidated by this guest that he literally has been on the list of people I wanted to contact for 4 years. And the reason I could not get myself to do it was, as I explained to him, he's too many jams. And you're just going to have to wait till the next episode to figure out what that means. But it's Professor Richard Wiseman, and he is too many jams. And we got him down to 4 or 5 jams. It was very manageable, but we still could have talked to him for another hour. The very charming, the very funny, the very interesting, a guy with great stories.
Yeah. And now if you're like me, folks, and you're going, who? Who's he talking about? Who? Dr. Richard who? That's where I was exactly. I did not know from Richard Wiseman. This is a great interview. He is so insightful, smart, wise, charming. Don't miss this one because it's really great. You know what you're going to do? This is the danger of this guy. He's got his own podcast.
Yes, we might lose people.
Switch podcasts after listening to him. He's fascinating.
Yeah, if you want to get a jump on him, the podcast is called Richard Wiseman's On Your Mind. We cover a couple of the topics that he's covered in that, plus other stuff. You could also go to YouTube and look up Quirkology. He's got a huge page there with tons and tons of videos. Richard Wiseman, Quirkology on YouTube. We'll talk to him next time, and we're going to have Chapter 9 of The Miser's Dream. So we'll see you folks next episode. Take care.
I can't wait. Bye-bye, everybody.
This has been Behind the Page, the Eli Marks podcast, with your hosts, John Gaspard and Jim Cunningham, produced by Alberts Bridge Books at Grass Lake Studios. Find this podcast and all the books in the Eli Marks series at elimarksmysteries.com. That's ELIMARKS, mysteries.com. And thanks for listening.